Let's stop flying 747-sized patterns in small GA aircraft. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We talk about safety issues here on Mondays, and we're going to talk about one today that I think maybe we've all been guilty of, especially if we've been through primary flight training that involved flight at towered airports. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Well, Paul, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
Let's talk about an article you headlined, Please, Let's Put an End to Those Airliner-Sized Patterns, in the December issue of Over the Airwaves. I've seen this happen. I find it amusing, but it really could be dangerous as well. Tell us what you're talking about.
Well, you know, we train here right in the shadow of a large Class C airport, Buffalo International Airport, and we also are ringed by a number of non-towered fields that are common training sites for a number of flight schools in the area. And invariably, we'll find ourselves at an airport doing what we consider to be a normal, relatively tight pattern, and then we'll encounter somebody who's out on a three-mile-wide downwind. They'll turn base 2.5 miles from the runway, and etiquette suggests that we follow nose to tail in line, but we're not sure we're even seeing them, and they're calling for us, and we're calling for them, and we wind up with basically two simultaneous parallel patterns going on to the same airport. The accident data is pretty clear on the fact that we have more air traffic, more collisions and more accidents in the traffic pattern than anywhere else, and logically because there's more airplanes per volume of space. It's imperative, in my opinion, that we get this pattern, this traffic pattern, under control in everybody's mind as to what the appropriate size really needs to be. And in my opinion, the appropriate size needs to be fairly tight. So, as one indication would be, if we lost an engine, theoretically, we could make the runway from any point in the pattern. There's no need to have a 2 or 3 mile wide pattern unless you're a Boeing 747, deciding to make an approach to the local community airport, which doesn't happen. So there's no reason for it.
All right. Now, this is taught to people. I know I had an instructor in my primary training who told me that if I was in the right place for the pattern for that aircraft and that airport, he should be able to pull the throttle on me at any point once I was established on downwind, and I should be able to make the runway. It might not be pretty, but I'd at least get onto the airport and get the plane down safely. And this was in an Aranca Champ that, we were talking about 70 on downwind, 60 on base, and, something like 38 at touchdown. But a lot of instructors seem to teach people to fly these huge patterns.
Well, I think they teach it because, particularly in our area, where they're coming out of a home base, a flight school based in a tower-controlled airport, where the tower is calling the turns, and they're calling wide turns in order to for spacing purposes. And so the hapless student who's trained in a large tower-controlled airport finds himself or herself over at a non-towered airport. Just think of the point that you made, being able to make the field on a failed engine. That's one issue, but a much more common problem is the ability to see a wind indicating device. I defy anybody to see a tetrahedron and figure out which way it's pointing from a 2.5 mile wide downwind. You can't see it. I'm sure you can barely see the windsock. So clearly, we need to be in close enough that with normal 20/20 vision, we ought to be able to see any wind indicating device on the field from anywhere we are in the pattern. And think about it. There is just no other reason to be maneuvering that far away from the airport in a wide pattern. Plus, we can't see other airplanes. When we're all spread out 2 or 3 miles apart, and we're talking about small aircraft here, it doesn't work. More training is needed. We just have to get our people to use these pattern approaches to keep them in fairly tight.
Okay, now, you talk about Class G airports. Obviously, you can be in a situation where you've got simultaneously in the pattern a guy in a J3 and a guy in a Lancer. The pattern size for those two guys is going to vary pretty widely. If you're at a speed where you're going to have to make bigger turns, you need to be farther out. how do you practically deal with this at an airport where you have that kind of a mix of traffic?
You know, it is difficult when we have airplanes of grossly different speeds. Just like it's a little, it's sometimes difficult on the interstate highway systems when, for that reason, they, you know, there's a certain minimum speed required. You know, minimum speed 45, maximum speed 65. In airplanes, you know, clearly we can't have this. So in that odd case where we have a citation coming in, or even you know, something a little bit quicker than what we're flying, then certainly we have to make accommodation for that, and we do the best we can. You know, at the large air shows, Oshkosh and Sun and Fun, they put us at different altitudes, but here again, those are tower controlled operations that are kind of metering things in the final analysis. I think we're better off being in close where we can see people than being 2 miles away from the airport and then try to follow in line. So, yeah, sure, there's exceptions where we have to broaden it out or extend a downwind in order to accommodate somebody on a straight in who may be moving faster than we are. But short of that, we simply need to keep these patterns in close enough where we can keep an eye on each other.
All right, when we come back from the break, Bob, let's talk about something slightly related to this topic, and that is an article you titled The Magic of a Stabilized Approach. Bob Miller is my guest. Back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Freedom through control. Cirrus has completely reinvented the personal aircraft and the entire experience of owning a personal aircraft. It's a bold new take on private aviation that we call Cirrus Flying 2.0. You set the schedule. You chart the course. You're in control.
Welcome back to the ANN special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. And we're going to move on now to a topic Bob titled The Magic of a Stabilized Approach. And Bob, I think most of us know what a stabilized approach is, but go ahead and define it and tell us why there's even any argument about this.
There's an old school, a new school, a different ways of thinking about how we make approaches into airports that have been discussed over the years. But the stabilized approach is simply a constant rate of descent at a constant speed and in a fixed configuration on the airplane. And it's a little difficult to talk about it. I have it diagrammed in this issue of Over the Airwaves. But the stabilized approach really begins out on the downwind leg where we get our airplane configured for landing. We're getting our speeds under control. We turn on base. And then on final, we make one continuous constant rate, and I say constant rate, feet per minute descent to a aiming point on the runway. And when we do this, it gives us adequate time to make adjustments if necessary. The variables are limited to very few, in fact, variables. Once we have our power set, our speed set, configuration set, and everything is then just simply a final ride to the runway.
I still hear people who say that this is just an airline deal, that this is not something that someone in a small plane has to be concerned with. How do you respond to that?
Well, we had an incident here just this past weekend with one of our flight instructors and a student where clearly not involved in a stabilized approach. They clipped a landing light, nothing serious, no real damage, just a scratch to the airplane, but it was just a little bit low. And when I asked the instructor, where were you in relationship to the painted aiming point on the runway? And he said, well, clearly I was trying to allow the student to make the necessary corrections so that he could learn from his mistake. And I assure you the student did learn from his mistake, but that was a classic example of a non-stabilized approach. So, you know, I'm not sure where to draw the line here other than to say that if we can become stabilized, certainly at an altitude of 1,000 feet before hitting the runway, you know, that last 1,000 feet, usually final approach fix inbound, everything's configured on speed, on rate of descent, on configuration, and then pointing to that aiming point. My goodness, the rest of this thing should be just a walk in the park until we touch down on the runway.
All right, let's talk now about inexperienced or low-time pilot, private pilot workload coming into a towered airport where the tower sends you out on an extended downwind and messes with all your calculations of feet per minute over distance and time. Is it appropriate to try to work into that workload at that point the calculations that you need to make a stabilized approach?
You know, if we're not absolutely comfortable with the with what the controller is asking us to do in terms of a stabilized approach, that magic one-word response should be keyed in by the pilot to the air traffic control, air traffic controller, and that one word, of course, is unable. You know, we've all been asked to make an expedited approach or a short approach or keep our speed up. You know, we can do that within a certain limit. Once we're being asked to do a slam dunk approach, and this is a term that is often seen, particularly, you know, in low weather approaches where they're trying to get us down quickly, keep the traffic moving. At that point, the pilot might well best say unable and then just ask for a heading or a vector around for another approach so that they can do it properly. We see far too many landing accidents as a result of an unstabilized approach, and that is because somebody was in a hurry to get something done.
All right, if you're coming in a small plane, say a 172 to a 8,000-foot runway, and they ask for an expedited approach, and you're not sure at that point even where you're going to touch down, are you really unable? I mean, is that pushing it too far? Because obviously, if you float for a ways before you get the wheels on the ground, it's not going to be the end of the world.
Well, that's right. And that's a consideration. You know, what kind of runway do I have to work with? If I have an 8,000-foot runway and I'm in a Cessna 172, there's a lot of flexibility there. But if I'm on a shorter runway and more, you won't find these, you know, in tower-controlled airports to any great extent. But if we're, you know, for some reason hurried to make an approach into a short, you know, 4,000-foot runway because we're trying to beat somebody in who's on a long downwind or something like that, that's when we get ourselves into trouble.
Well, Bob, I hope folks will know that they need to work on this on every landing, because obviously there are occasions where folks don't think this is important. But I guess if you look at a lot of the causes of accidents that happen near airports, this obviously could have been a mitigating factor.
Well, this is the number one cause of all accidents. The number one cause of all non-fatal accidents. Fortunately, most of them are non-fatal. But the number one phase of flight significant enough to attract NTSB attention are landing accidents. And if we analyze those landing accidents, and unfortunately, they're not all video recorded, but if we could go back and look at each one of those landing accidents, I would judge that many of them were a result of a non-stabilized approach. I've had my own share of incidences on landings in various circumstances, and when I look back, you know, when it wasn't as pretty as I would have liked it myself, I'll go back and say to myself, that was not a stabilized approach in any way, shape, or form. And then I try to use that as a self-teaching exercise to prevent that from happening in the future. But ask our listeners, and they can ask themselves, you know, whenever you had a landing scenario that wasn't something you were terribly proud of, ask yourself, where did that landing begin? And it usually began out about a half a mile from the airport or more, where the approach was anything but stabilized.
If anybody would like to comment on that or on this topic or any other topic we talk about, you can do so to email at paulp, P-A-U-L-P, at aero-news.net. Bob, as always, we appreciate the robust discussion, and we'll talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Bob.
Find out more about Bob Miller's free newsletter and sign up to receive an email notice when each new issue is released at overtheairwaves.com. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.